That music means that I'm going to pass it over to Rob because I bogart the intros every time, and it's high time Rob got a chance to kick off an episode of this thing that we call what, Rob?
We call this the Lean Into Artcast. This is a podcast where we talk about visual storytelling. We talk to visual storytellers sometimes, and Jersey Droz, that's you, right?
That's me.
And we take a walk around a topic. Sometimes we go from the high level to going really deep. But today we're doing something different because we have special guest Ryan Estrada on the show.
How you doing, everybody?
Ryan Estrada.
My wife is frantically trying to tell me she wants to plug in something behind me.
As soon as he gets on stage. So Ryan Estrada, let me roll out all this man's credentials. RyanEstrada.com, Cartoon Commune, the whole story, the-whole-story.com. You might have heard about it, Kickstarter campaign. We'll talk more about that in a little bit.
World adventurer, blogger extraordinaire.
World adventurer, blogger, stand-up comedian. Actor,
game show host.
We got to start with that at the top of this one. Yeah. Ryan, you
just started. Just started recording Asking for Trouble with two very special guests in my first episode, Jersey and Rob.
That's me.
And there's my wife. Hi, guys. Say hello. What are you doing? What are you doing right now? Okay.
Okay, so yeah, I mean, we actually we had the honor of being guests on the first episode of Ryan's new game show, and it was interesting to see because I felt like I was invited to the fortress of an evil mastermind, and I just said, "Yeah, sure, I'll come over."
Yeah, I try to make it tricky. A lot of the what I'm doing is the questions are misleading topics that make you think you're going to talk about one thing and then you talk about something completely different.
It was a humbling and very, very fun experience.
It was super fun. And yeah, you know, I got a lot of questions about music and I tanked on them. But as I said on Google+, it's like, that's the fun of a game show. Nobody watches a game show to watch somebody ace it. You watch it to scream the answer before the contestant. And then yell at the contestant for not knowing what you knew, right? So,
What's super funny is that like your recruiting strategy? Because I'd swear, like, I think Dave Roman had empathy for me and or Jersey, where I even tweeted at him because it sounded like between, you know, because he tweeted me and his reaction to the show, and I said, you must have been shaking your fist at the screen, going, "Come on!"
But that's the fun.
And exactly, yeah. So I think it really got his you really tapped into his energy. And if I'm not mistaken, is he going to be on the next episode?
Yeah, next episode is going to be Dave Roman versus Dean Tripp.
That is awesome.
And I think the title is Silent Night versus Dark Night. Am I right?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And when is that airing, just for the folks?
That's going to be next
Wednesday.
I have to convert time zones. Yeah, next Wednesday. At 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Ah, so okay, we'll link to it in the show notes for the folks who listen right away. But yeah, just to put the Cliff's Notes version of this game show, it's held on Google+, and it's a quiz show where the questions are tailored to the contestants. So in the case when Rob and I were on, it was questions about heavy metal and questions about He-Man and the Masters of the Universe. But Ryan is very tricky and jumbles the titles and misdirects and misleads you, so that when I picked I Have the Power, it wasn't about He-Man. It was about power ballads, and I don't know anything about music. So, and then there's all sorts of cheats you can play where Ryan chooses the cheats by random selection, and you can either find yourself searching for the answer on AOL.com, or what was that chat client that Rob that you got sent to where you got sworn at by all those kids?
Omegle. I interrupted a bunch of people's very private, naughty discussions. But they had empathy for me and tried.
Yeah, you're lucky they tried. Like I was doing tests with Omegle to see if it would work on a game show, and everyone would just be like, tell me to do things to my various orifices. And I'm like, perfect, that's going in there.
I think he's really on a game show. I don't know.
Yeah, they probably didn't believe any of us that there was actually a game show.
That's too hard to role play. Knock that off. I don't know. Anyway,
I think in some future episodes I might have some of the lifelines involve not being allowed to tell people you're on a game show.
Oh,
just
no.
Randomly call someone, be like, "Oh, by the way, I was just wondering, what number Pixar film was Ratatouille?" Just for my own purposes.
What? I mean, yeah, exactly. I was sleeping. I'm eating supper. Anyway, that is, it was really cool because you got to see, I mean, it's like part game show, part reality show. And this guy, you have good, the audience participation too, with that cool, was it Six Clicks, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a whole lot of reason to watch it before or afterward, or, you know, during or afterward. You can't see it before, I guess. but you know,
I guess.
It was a lot of fun. Thanks for having us on, Ryan.
Yeah. Thanks for coming.
But yeah, you can find it by going to google.com/+RyanEstrada. That's where you can get to his Google Plus feed. So with that, we got to get to curveballs, and then we're going to dive into main topic. We're going to issue some of the typical format of the show with 1,000 feet up and on the ground, but we're still going to keep curveball in here because we got an email from a listener, and I'm hoping, Ryan, you can weigh in on this one as a guy who does some digital illustration. We got an email from Jesse Acosta, and he's at jesseacosta.net, and he said, "Finally diving into digital inking and really hitting a wall. I was given a Wacom Graphire 3 hand-me-down gift from a friend over the summer, but as we all know, it's hard to find the time learning new tools when we have projects calling our name. Well, I finally got the bug to play with this guy, and it's harder than it seems. I feel like a drunk baby trying to manipulate it. I draw fine on paper, but for some reason, I'm all thumbs when it comes to hand-eye coordination with the tablet. Any suggestions for warm-ups or other tips to refine my tablet skills? What do you guys think?"
Well, I'd say just play with it first. Don't jump into a project with a tool you're not comfortable with, because the reason to use a new tool on a project is to help you save time. But if it's gonna make that project last longer and not look the way you want it, just play around. Maybe do like a quick comic. Just do some sketches. Maybe do like a 24-hour comic style challenge with it. That's how I learn new tools, and if I like them and figure out a way that it would work for a project I'm doing, then after that I'll take it to the project.
Yeah, very cool. How about you, Jersey? What do you think?
I can only underline what Ryan said with black crayon. I mean, that's exactly how I learned, and I've told the story a million times. It's how I learned the brush pen. I started doing a warm-up sketch. Mm-hmm. Where I just set a timer, 20 minutes, that's all I get to do a warm-up sketch with this thing. And I started doing those cartoon character sketches, limited my realm of what I can draw. A, has to be something that's easy for me to draw, something I can almost draw from memory. B, it has to be a pose that I can easily rattle out. I'm not rethinking anything here. I'm not trying any kind of artistic challenges. All I'm trying to do is do what comes easy to me with a new tool. And then I set a timer, I stick to it, and then the first several sketches were garbage, and eventually I got the hang of it. And after a year of doing that, I feel like I can ink with a brush now, you know. But I didn't use it on any project where I was under deadline or I was getting paid for it. It was just about being playful with it. What were you going to say, Rob?
Well, there's a couple of things. Just thinking back to what helped me get used to it is I actually did anything from just setting aside my mouse and just using it for normal operation. To just, I need to click on a menu. I need to right click something. And it just, I'm not under pressure to actually create something visual, but just, you know, go about my business. So I'm familiarizing myself with it, but yet not under that pressure. And another exercise I found really helpful was from an Imagine Effects magazine years ago, that there was an artist gave the advice about if you hold your hand in front of your computer screen and then try to get, you know, try to trace around it while on your tablet. So essentially you're doing some really big time remapping of like how you're perceiving space and whatnot. And it forces a different way of getting used to the thing. And you're also familiar with your hand and familiar with, you know, perhaps tracing hands and stuff. So it's a way to do that spatial remapping thing, which I think that's one of the weird aspects of a tablet that just eventually disappears. Like all the, you know, it's a huge stumbling block until it's gone forever. So.
And, this may not be much of an issue anymore. I'm going to my Tumblr, let me go to my Tumblr right now. Did you guys see that news about that tablet that Krishna Sadasivam reviewed recently?
Oh, man. Yeah.
I've seen that. The Unova. Oh, what is it called? I'm trying to look it up real quick. I should have pulled this up before. Ray Frendon posted about it on Tumblr, and I reblogged, and I'll put it in the show notes. The Unova MSP19U Cintiq Alternative, and it's like $500 for a 19-inch Cintiq-style tablet, and then they have a 10-inch version for $400. Crazy.
Wow. Yeah, that's huge. Obviously, there's a different problem there. So, have you drawn on you've been drawing on your tablet, right?
Yeah, the Galaxy Note.
Your Galaxy Note. And so have you noticed there's typically sort of a small spatial remapping that you have due to the distance between the place where your ink would be affecting, and you're kind of drawing on glass though in front of it. You're not really on top of the art.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, Ryan, you ran into this when you had, did you used to have a Modbook at one point?
Yeah, I had a Cintiq for a while, and then I had a Modbook. And one thing people don't realize is that even between those two, it's a completely different learning process, because I cannot draw on a Cintiq. It's kind of like drawing on a whiteboard for me, because you have this big thing that's in front of you, and you have to draw, you know, vertically, which is something I can't do. And then when I switched to the Modbook, I would hold it like a sketchbook, and it felt more comfortable to me, but I've still never been able to master drawing the way I want to on with a tablet of any kind. Like I'll use it if I send something to a client and they're like, will you change the eyes? I can erase and draw a new element with it, but I can't build a whole new character like that the way I want to.
Yeah.
That reminds me of another aspect that helped me to get used to it was I would actually do my art, my primary art generation and refinement in natural media, and then scanning and then using the tablet to then do the inking or the coloring just seemed to be easier because I'm working within these other boundaries that they were less daunting and difficult to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
Like I was adjusting instead of making something brand new.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I still don't draw entirely on the tablet. I think I've done one project. I did one. I take it back. I'm digital inking now in Manga Studio. But before that, I did a coloring book in Photoshop with the tablet. And that was years ago, but it was a coloring book where the art wasn't, coloring books typically aren't very demanding in terms of detail and precision. But the way I got sort of under the hood of the Wacom tablet or the graphics tablet is just coloring my work and using the lasso tool and paintbrush tool that way because, yeah, you're working within the you're embellishing, you're not drawing from scratch, right? So That's another thing to think about is just use it for coloring for a while. But I also really like the idea of just using it like create like a warm-up exercise where I'm just going to draw something that's really easy for me to draw. I'm going to do it every day. I'm going to set a timer. And I'm going to save them in a folder so I can watch my progress and then be able to hold them up against each other to see that there's progress happening. A. Dodson in the chat is saying, another exercise is just playing some kind of browser game using the tablet pen. Bonus points if it requires quick and accurate clicking. That's good too.
Neat.
And another thing about working with any new tool is don't focus on trying to make it look exactly like the work you normally do with the old tool. Because if you're doing that, there's no point in doing it. Like I have drawn comics completely with a tablet, but they're like when I tried to make something look like paper cut, like when I did the old Frank comic, I did a whole series that looked like paper cut. And there was like a children's book one that looked like watercolor and just things that I don't normally do. And it looked completely different. It works perfectly for that because I'm not sitting there trying to, no, this doesn't look like the way it would look if I drew it with a pen.
Cool.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's another thing to point out is that like if you're trying to replicate something you're already doing on paper, why not just keep doing what you're doing on paper then? What's the point of reinventing or repurposing a digital tool to do like embrace what? And that's what I think I learned when I was learning the brush pen was I was trying to originally make it do what I was doing with a crow quill. And then eventually I learned, oh, wait, the brush does different stuff and I can celebrate that different stuff. And that's when it started to make sense to me, you know? So I think we walked around that one.
Oh, yeah.
All right. So thank you, Jesse Acosta of jesseacosta.net, where you can check out his portfolio. And I want to say to the listeners, if you guys have a curveball that you want to throw at us and watch us try to take a swing at it, it doesn't have to be anything as much as an advice question. It can just be a kind of a what if question or a what about the color red question. It could be like a really abstract thing that Rob and I have to really wrestle with. So you can send your response via MP3 and we can play it on the show, or you can just type it up in an email and there's a contact form on the Lena Tart website. Be sure to check the box that says I give you permission to read it on the air. And hey, include your web address in there and you'll get a shout out on the show. So thank you again, Jesse. Rob, is it time to hit topic?
Let's hit the topic.
All right. Well, I'm going to hit the music for the topic. Oh, and it sounds dangerous.
Uh-oh.
Because we're going to try to fit a lot of stuff in this episode. Because when we're talking about Ryan Estrada, you can't sum him up in just one topic.
No, we need three topics.
Yeah, we're going to do three topics today. And I want to start with something you posted, Ryan, at the end of 2012. You posted this on Google Plus and Tumblr, and it was sort of an essay called Do It Wrong, I think is what the title of the essay was. Let me
pull Manifesto.
It. Yeah.
Yeah, it was like a manifesto, wasn't it? Is that how that thing started, Ryan? Like what kind of what bee was in your bonnet?
I don't think anything particular was in my bonnet, just kind of I was thinking to myself while working and just kind of figured out a way to express something that I've been trying to express for a while in a series of tweets that didn't really get across in 140 characters.
Cool. And this thing has been liked or reblogged on Tumblr 21,000 times, almost 22,000 mm-hmm. times. I don't know how many times on Google Plus.
This thing got went a bit around. Viral.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you made a viral, as the kids say. But yeah. So like this thing is a manifesto where, you know, like to sum it up is you're basically saying that the secret to this whole being great at this art stuff is to do it entirely wrong and sort of like kind of splashing water in the face of recipes. Mm-hmm. To become a good artist, focus on making perfect art. Don't show weakness. Use the tools that everyone else recommends. If you can't draw hands, put them in pockets. If you can't draw feet, crop them off the page, etc. To become a great artist, though, make a bunch of crappy art. Do things wrong. Trust me, even the art you think is great, give it a few years and you'll think it's crap. So you might as well shoot for the moon. Grab the tools that no one else has ever imagined using and see what happens. So I guess I can kick it off with... some of my responses or reactions to this thing is that it's a longish post, but not TLDR long. People should check it out at ryanestrada.com.tumblr.com or on your Google Plus page. We'll link to it in the show notes. But you mm-hmm. made an interesting point in point two. Instead of ignore the haters, you twist the whole idea to ignore the bad teachers. Mm-hmm. That was pretty cool.
Yeah, because I mean. So many people get upset when they get criticism, but like criticism is like I paid a ridiculous amount of money to go to a college to hire people to tell me what I'm doing is wrong and criticize my work. Like people pay hundreds of thousands of dollars to be criticized. And then when someone online says, this doesn't look right, they're like, go to hell, hater. Like, that was free, man. Listen to it. Maybe the guy did a terrible job and said, this comic sucks because blank. Mm-hmm. Instead of, it would improve if you did this. But just like you said, think of it as he's a bad teacher and not he's telling you you're a bad artist.
So how are you reconstituting the bad teacher? I mean, it could be... that's really hard to sift through that, right? Where if someone just kind of drops a negative bomb on your post, how do you recover that into something?
Well, I basically recover it by just really, really enjoying getting negative feedback. Like even when like someone's trolling me, it's just really fun to read for me. I guess just, I have that weird outlook on life where nothing ever bothers me. So it's a benefit. A lot of people don't really have that. So you just kind of got to think of it as, you know, like if you put something online, no matter how perfect what you put online is or that you give to the world, a lot of people are going to give you crap about it. You just got to realize that and not take it personally.
But you care about the art, right? I mean, this is the hard thing to describe, Ryan, is you're describing not being personally attached to people's responses to it, but the art comes from a very personal place, right?
Yeah. I know that I like it. I'm my target audience, so as long as I like it, I think I'm pretty good. And for every person that doesn't like something I do, there's other people that say they do like it, so I figure there has to be something right in there, even if this person complaining is right, there must be something good in it. So why don't I look and see what are the good things about my work and what are the bad things?
Right, right. This harkens back to an earlier episode of Lean Into Art where we were answering a listener email, and it was the question of how do you deal with, you know, critiques, especially when the critiques are a little bit on the rugged or aggressive side. And I think we kind of came to the conclusion of, well, the real evaluation is not the delivery, but whether or not it's useful to you. And if they're being a little bit too aggressive or rugged for your tastes, if there's a nugget of truth in there, if there's something that's like, you know what, I do need to rethink this, then it's good critique. It's good criticism that's helpful to you. And that's really what you should be looking for, not that personal response to it, but rather the... what can I learn from this? And if there's nothing to be learned, then as you pointed out, Ryan, I think that was a great way of saying it, is like chalk it up to them being a bad teacher and just move on.
And it's that, like, a lot of people are afraid to give feedback now because people do get so offended like that. Like, I really miss the days of college where we'd have like a 3-hour class that was nothing but critiquing each other's work. And sometimes if I really need something critiqued, like I'll email somebody I knew from college and be like, just pretend like we're in Ed Campbell's class and just tell me what you think about this. Cause, I loved my newest book, someone I know in Korea just made some simple suggestions, and then I just showed him the newest version I incorporated, and he was so excited. He's like, "Oh my God, I'm so glad. I assumed you thought I was a jerk for insulting your work." I'm like, "No, it works better. You made a good suggestion."
So some of this can be just like your mutation or your superpower, right? But it reminded me of it's like putting other artists in your situation. For some reason, I was reminded of Don Music from the Muppets, right?
Yeah.
Where a lot of artists, when they get into critique, all of a sudden it's a slippery slope, right? Where maybe this art is bad. Maybe I'll never create good art. Maybe I'm horrible. And all of a sudden I'm banging my head on the piano and, that kind of thing. Like, I mean, it's an interesting personality mix. And I'm wondering, like, how do you share that superpower in a way? Like, how do others get a foothold on that if they're more the Don Music type?
I don't think, I look at, getting, you know, not being offended by feedback the same way I look at the way I'm not upset when things go wrong in my life or when I'm traveling. Like I've mentioned on the show a lot, like I just, I write stories about things going wrong. So when things go wrong, I love it because I have stuff to talk about. But like, I don't know, maybe just think of it as entertainment. Like people's comments, like there's so many sites that post like funny things people post online and insulting each other, like for other people. Just whenever something is said about you, just imagine it's being said about someone else and just picture it as a funny story. I don't know, just kind of step back and I don't know how to not take something personally because I never take anything personally.
I think that's a really clever idea though, Ryan. Like I was wondering if you could have, I mean, I think you might've just bottled it up. So it's not a bad, I mean, it's probably not perfect as a recipe, but I think it's a good exercise to say, well, okay, well, what if this isn't about me, right? Or this is actually about someone else. And then, well, there you go. Now it's safe to play around with it and explore it.
Well, and he specifically used the word stepping back. And one of the things, it reminds me of, I did a Thunder Punch Daily about this years ago when I did a big I did a talk for a big group of people in this town, and like the mayor was there, and like the chief of police was there, and it was like a kind of a big whoop-de-doo for the town. And I thanked the wrong town. I did that, you know, where like you go on stage.
I love that episode.
Yeah. And like 500 people in this room, and I thought I saved it. I thought I saved the day. I turned it around and I made a joke out of it, and I did this great presentation, and everybody was laughing along with me. And so I thought, whew, got out of that one okay. And then 75 to 100 people came up afterwards and shook my hand and said, that was a great presentation. Too bad about that thing you did at the top, though. Like, after, like, the 50th person, I was like, oh, my God, I'm the worst human being who ever lived. And then I was driving home. I was like, well, you know what? And I thought of my Obi-Wan Kenobi ghost, Ryan Estrada, sitting next to me saying, like, well, don't worry. You got a good story. This is going to make people laugh someday. And I thought, well, yeah, you know, 5 years from now, I'm going to be able to tell this story, and it's going to be good for a few chuckles of, like, watch me get humiliated. I looked at the camera like Bob Newhart and blinked, you know. So thinking about separating yourself from the moment to say, well, let's look at this from 5 years from now, goggles. Yeah. That'll help, too.
Right? Well, another thing I talked about in doing it wrong is that if people have enough of a reaction to tell you about it and to complain about it, it means they were listening and you grabbed them. Like, I can think of a lot of speeches I've heard in my life that I could not remember a single line of. Like, yeah. If they remember something you said at the beginning, that means they were listening to your speech. You grabbed them.
Yeah.
So, like, the fact that they have that thing they can hold on to and talk to you about, whether they're saying it's good or bad, that's a compliment.
You're affecting people, right? This is in point three in the piece, is that you say making people feel something is an important part of improving one's art. Mm-hmm. And it reminds me of something Dan Mishkin once said in a writing workshop. It's like, your first job is to create characters that an audience will care about. And caring about something can mean a lot of things, right? Caring about something can mean also that you actively despise it, right? You despise that character. You're invested emotionally. You got them to react emotionally. So that's an important thing to underline there.
Yeah. Another thing I talked about is whenever someone expresses an emotion, even if they say something made them feel uncomfortable, that's something you want to think about. Why did it make them uncomfortable? And the thing it made them feel, is it ever something I want to make someone feel? Because, you know, like, if something has shock value, that's not necessarily something you want, but like simple things like artists always point out, like when there's a tangent in your artwork, it makes them notice it. Or like, just if you draw someone too small and there's too much empty space, it makes the character look lonely. Maybe you didn't mean for that, but once someone notices that, when you need to make a character lonely, you can make that same mistake purposely and control their mind. It's kind of like when someone gives an emotional reaction, they're basically giving you the ability to read their mind and know how you did it. There's this movie that I can't remember the name of it right now. I saw this Thai horror movie once where the very opening scene is this taxi driver taking someone to a hotel, and she says, I don't have any money. Can I come out in a couple minutes and give you the money? And she's like, yeah, sure. Then she goes in and you don't never see that character again. And it was bugging me the entire film. I'm like, she never went out and paid that guy. Where's the frigging guy? And I remembered this the entire film about the editing mistake that they made. And at the very end, after this whole movie, you cut out to that guy who's still waiting for his money and goes in and finds the house empty, and you realize the woman was a ghost. Like, they totally did that on purpose to make you wonder where that guy was. It wasn't a mistake.
Yeah, that's cool.
That's super cool.
So whatever mistakes you make, you may need to take them out of this project, but remember when you can use them for another one.
Super cool. I want to highlight one more thing in this. I mean, it's a great, great blog post. Everybody who makes art should read it. And as a matter of fact, I think in the title of it, you say, you know, whether you're a comic artist or a musician or, you know, anybody who creates content, they should read this. But this, I think, is a great summation, or maybe a slogan for the Ryan Estrada viewpoint, or the Ryan Estrada sort of, if you want to look through his goggles for a day, this is the expression that I think of, is, I could put art on that. Because, you know, there's one thing that's consistent about you is you're always coming up with crazy new ideas, and you're spitballing all the time, and, you know, recently, some of these things have been really doing well for you. Historically, things have done pretty okay for you. You know, the cartoon Kamiyan thing was a successful project. But it comes out of this sense of this looking at things around you and saying, I could put art on that. And that's one of the pieces in the talk or the blog post that you did is keep your eye out for that stuff. What is the thing you could put art on? And that's when you can invent. But that's not a mindset that I think not every cartoonist, visual storyteller, or artist is necessarily thinking that way. But I think that's something that people should massage their brains into.
Yeah, I mean, just like whenever I talk about Google Plus to anyone who's not on Google Plus, they're like, dude, that Google Plus is dead. Nobody puts comics on there. And I'm like, yeah, I'm the only one doing it. That's why I have, a million and a half people reading them. Even when I give feedback to the people at Google Plus, like about how it doesn't really work for comics in some ways, they're like, oh yeah, it was never really intended for comics. So like it's not a perfect place to put comics, but there's a lot of things it does well. And if you're the only one that knows that audience and knows what kind of content they enjoy and knows a way to put your comics on it, you're going to get a lot of attention. Now, it doesn't mean someone else can follow that exact path now and become successful doing it. But if you see somewhere that you think I could put my art in this place and you're the only one doing it, you're going to find a way to grab the attention of those people using it.
Yeah.
It's it really sounds like you've got you've cultivated this mindset of looking for interesting things to create, but not just that, but also how to achieve your goals with that, and which is somehow affecting people, right?
Well, I think what I do is I just do things that I enjoy doing and look for places I can put them so other people can see them. I don't really like I always say on the show, like I have a lot of post-rationalized thoughts about why things worked, but I don't think about that before I do them. I just kind of do things the way that work for the work that I make and the lifestyle that I have. And that's part of the doing it wrong thing. Like the whole time I was going through high school and college, I was writing to all my favorite cartoonists and I was writing to Disney and all these studios and newspaper cartoonists, asking them advice. And I got a lot of advice that has helped me, but I haven't followed a single thing any of them said. Like not a single person said, why don't you go live in Korea and sell PDFs for whatever people want to pay on the internet while the only stuff you print is in Korean that you sell at Korean Comic Cons and you supplement that by drawing stuff for expos for customers around the world. Like no one ever suggested that, but it's working for me.
Yeah, it's tough. It is like everything is in context of your situation. And it's like no business can exactly follow someone else's business plan because it depends on, well, where are you at and how are you supplied with whatever ideas or goods or on all that stuff. It's just context matters a lot. Mm-hmm. So that's so funny. So what is the percent of what was salvageable from these other paths? Because one thing that this reminds me of is it's a little bit of like a punk rock ethic, right? Mm-hmm. Where you just kind of, you do what you do and it's your skill and your voice is true. And you just get out and express it and stuff, where that's a little bit counter to, well, for instance, like the different established folks of their own paths of success that you sought some advice initially, that it reminds me of like sort of institutional knowledge and whatnot, and versus like the punk rock ethic. So what is salvageable in your approach across the two?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's just like a lot of the advice people gave me was like about how to get into syndicates and stuff and like how to create a hook that catches syndicate's attention, which is completely different from how I would catch the attention of anyone that reads my stuff now. But like it taught me the value of having a hook in the way you explain something. Doesn't mean necessarily you write something in a different way, but you need to find a way to explain it in an elevator pitch. You need a sentence that makes people want to look for more information. Mm. So the skills that they taught me are completely different, but in teaching me those skills, they made me realize I need to figure out how this applies to what I do now.
Ah, yeah. So it's neat. So there are certain ways, but how you applied it, you had to figure out on your own.
Yeah.
It's the difference between following a recipe and probing what the recipe is accomplishing. and applying that with new, with your own ingredients. I mean, I hate to use that. I mean, that's a pretty cheap metaphor, but it's like, you know, like it flies. It's not just as a simple refutation of the schedule of life, but more of no, instead of just following the schedule, think deeply about the schedules that other people have followed and learn how to apply that hard won knowledge to your own schedule. Because when somebody's giving advice, they can only speak from their own experience.
Yeah. When you're reading about other people that you're like interested in how they did their careers, like don't just read about when they were successful. Like when I was in high school, my favorite thing to read about was like the histories of like the Warner Brothers animators and stuff. And it's so interesting to hear about like when they made no money and when they all these things that are so successful now, when they were created, the reason they were created is because no one else would publish what they were making. And it's interesting to see how they figured out a way to make this unpublishable thing publishable. Because following their model isn't going to help your work. You need to see what kind of things they thought about and think about that with your work if you want to get super.
Instead of like the results, it's more of their process of how they adapted and the ways in which they adapted to then cause that transition, instead of looking at, well, this is after it all worked. And, you know, in Jersey's metaphor, you know, we didn't talk about how we got really creative and scrounged to make some delicious pie. We just looked at the delicious pie at the end. And now we just talk about that versus the strategy to get there. That's
Yeah, I think that's a great way of looking at it, is look at the part where they're struggling and not what lucky breaks did they get, what process did they use, what tools did they use, what kind of character did they create that captured the nation's imagination, but what was their problem-solving process, right? How did they address the problem? What was their attitude? What was their viewpoint? What was the unique way that they looked at this thing? I think that's the part. And, you know, it's like this, we come back to this again and again, is that it's, we love to tell the story of predestination. I was interviewed, it's going to be updated in like a month or two. I was on another podcast, and I was asked about the story of how I decided to be a cartoonist at the age of 10 years old in the summer of 1985. And I kind of cringe now when I tell that story, because I've told it enough that I realize it sounds like I'm describing my cartooning career as predestination, and to which I quickly threw in, if you look at my career, it's clear it's not predestined, you know, but just because you're gripped by something in your youth, there's a temptation there to tell that Disney story of I was born to do this thing. And anybody who's successful was born to do that thing. But when you go back and look at the points when they're struggling, they're just faking it like everybody else, right? Or even after they're successful, they're just faking it like everybody else.
Yeah, and the way you become successful isn't by, you know, we've been talking about overthinking all these things, but it's not like when you do something successful, it's not because you sat and said, okay, this person did this, how can I relate it to this? Like I said, I do things that I want to do. They either work out or they don't. And after the fact is when I can kind of figure out, okay, this is kind of like when this person did this and this person did that. And then it's just kind of in my head. And the next time I have an idea, it's based on all those things that I've thought about, but it's not me sitting down and saying, how can I make a successful business plan for this? It's just kind of a constant process of thinking and making your brain work in certain ways.
Yeah. So, okay, well, we got to get to these other points. And Rob, I want to give you a chance. Did we miss anything that you wanted to respond to
on
Brian's post?
Okay. I think everyone should read the post. We got through it.
Doing It Wrong, and that's on his Tumblr and on his Google+. It will be linked in the show notes. Bookmark it, pocket it, read it later, print it out. You know, I think it's going to stand the test of time. Now let's move on to Conventioning Report. Korean Comic Con. So you did another long post. Google+, lessons from Korean Comic Cons, Ryan. So you were on the last time you were on the show, you were giving us a sort of a conventioning UI report with some lessons learned, observations made. And since then, you've attended some other shows. Because how often are there Comic Cons where you live?
Well, the cons that I talked about last time, they happen every 2 months. Every 2 months, there's one in Busan, one in Seoul. And I'm just now finding out about so many other shows. Like, I'm going to another one this weekend. I can't exhibit at because I didn't find out about it until like 2 days after the deadline. But that happens like every 3 months in another part of Korea. There's like 10 others I've recently found out about. So I'm going to be doing a lot of conventioning.
Wow. And this is awesome because this has given you a lot of opportunities to iterate mm-hmm. and build upon past experiences. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I just want to hit some of the headlines on this. This is a pretty, this is a great and lengthy and robust post on your Google Plus again, which will be linked in the show notes. But I don't know. Maybe I should just hand it off to you, Ryan, and say, like, what are some of the headlines you would point out of, like, what have you picked up on that have stood out as the biggest learning experiences of exhibiting this often over the past couple months?
Yeah, well, like I was saying in the post, it's really fun to do. Like, I probably haven't made, if I actually factor in all the money I've spent on different displays, I probably haven't made a dime on Korean shows yet, but it's just so much fun to experiment that I just kind of make a whole new setup every time and see how people react differently. And it's fun because it's the same shows in the same venues with a lot of the same people. And I have some new stuff for the next set of shows, but basically I've been selling the same merchandise every time. But I can attract a completely new audience just by changing one thing on my table. Because there's so much stuff to see in that convention center. You got people just walking right, you know, thousands of people per hour just walking right past your table. But like, One of the things I was talking about, my takeaway from the last time, is I wanted to go vertical because at an American con, everything's horizontal. You set stuff out on your table. People come look at the table. Whereas at Korean shows, it's kind of like a teller window where there's this big thing in front and just a little window where you slide in money, and all around here is artwork. And people's eyes don't like, when you look at something that quickly, and especially when it's so packed, like, people's eyes don't adjust, be like, oh, this stuff's down here, I'm going to look at it. If there's nothing in this line of sight, they just see me and keep going. So I didn't want to spend too much money at first. So
comic.
Yep. Scary white guy. Yeah. And another thing I was talking about in the post, like, one of the things that is, a hurdle I have to cross is that a lot of people are scared to talk to me, not because of of racism, but just because, you know, they all are so trained to speak English and like it's drilled into their heads. They have to speak it perfectly, that talking to a foreigner is like taking a math test. And they're like, man, I just came for look at comics. I'm not here for a test.
Oh, wow. I did sign up for the test.
Yeah. So like, I wanted to test that this time, and I just kind of made one little vertical thing. I just printed each piece with my home printer and cut them out. And that kind of caught a lot of people's attention, got a lot more people looking. And then like in the moment, like on the second day, someone made a suggestion to, like I did that drawing wall that I did before, that I showed you guys, that it just wasn't working in Seoul like it did in Busan. So I erased all the drawings and I just put a bunch of pages from the comic on there and just a wall of artwork from the comic, and had that facing out toward where people enter. And a lot of people saw that and it just kind of caught their attention. And I had a lot of people that were like afraid to talk to me that would just hide around the corner from my booth and look at the page and realize, okay, this is in Korean. Okay, this looks interesting. Okay. And then they just kind of sneak around and just throw down money, grab a book and run away.
So wait, why? Any thoughts, theories on why the drawing wall worked in one location and not another?
I don't know. It's just a different audience. You never know what an audience is going to respond to. And that's why one of the points in the thing was be willing to change what doesn't work even in the moment. You don't have to think, okay, next year when I do a con, I won't do this. Like, even if you spent like $1,000 on a banner and put it up, if it's somehow turning people off, take it down. Who cares how much money you spent on it? It's costing you money. Like,
so you are not ever going to be a victim of sunk cost fallacy, I would say. Cause that's when, so you spend money on something and a lot of people dig in then. It's like, that's it. I don't care what happens. I'm riding this thing down to the bottom of the ocean. I spent a grand on this sign. Mm-hmm. I don't care, you know, if I chase everyone out of this place, you know, I'll do it with this sign. I mean, so.
Yeah, well, yeah, the way I think about it is if I already spent it, now I've never spent $1,000 anything for a con. That was just the number I threw out in air. But like if you spent $1,000 as an investment to make this much money. So now you have the opportunity to spend $0 as an investment to make even more money by just taking down the stupid sign that's direct. Like, like some of the examples I talked about
you
in the post.
You should be a business consultant. You know, that's awesome.
There's a lot of banners that people use every month at the Korean cons, like just some beautiful art of these characters, but the characters are going. And so I see this character and I look at their finger and I follow their point of view and they're pointing to the next table. So my eye goes to the next table and I buy what they're selling.
Oops.
Like, you know, I am actually aware of this enough that I can then force my eye to look down at the table. But these thousands of people that are walking past every hour are not going to do that. So if it's doing that, then like, that's why with mine, it's literally a character reading the book that I want them to buy, which is shaped like a V and pointing down at the books. And then a person pointing at the books that I want them to buy. And also I've seen a lot of people that like you know, in America, they don't happen every 2 months. So some people do a convention every year and they spend so much on a banner that they're still using it 10 years later, even though their art style has completely changed. And this banner is an example of how they drew 10 years ago. It doesn't look very good. It doesn't look very eye-catching, but they're so used to using it and they spent so much money on it that they'll keep using it.
It's my brand. Don't take away my brand.
Yeah. And if that's the first thing people see and it's not your best work, you haven't grabbed them. I'd rather have a small thing that's going to catch their eye and make them say, oh, that looks good, than a big thing that says, eh.
Yeah.
Always looking for that, what resonates, it sounds like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a lot of fun just watching people's eyes, where they go and what they do when they hit the table. Because like I was talking about the thing, you need to think of a table the same way you think when you're setting up a comic panel. It's a layout. Your eye is going to, something is going to catch their eye, and where does their eye go after that? I found also the more I fill the table with the thing I want them to buy, the more they'll buy it. Cause like at first they kept buying the little tiny pocketbooks that I showed you last time, that I was selling for 500 or 50 cents. And no one was buying the books. And I realized that just, I had so much of the table devoted to explaining what was in those little packs that that's what they saw. But then as soon as I, you know, 90% of the surface is covered with this, they're like, oh, there's a book for sale. And that's what they look at, is the book. And a lot of times they would buy both, but whatever grabs their attention first is what they're going to spend most time thinking about.
So you're talking about being like really focused on what's happening around you the entire time you're at the con. Now I'm guessing you do this just because you're fun. You think it's fun and you're fascinated by people probably. But I'm just saying that going back to some of our earlier discussion about like not analyzing the things they do, but the thinking they're doing, I'm trying to get at, you're describing an experience at a con where you are doing an awful lot of people watching and observing. And you know, responding on the fly, right?
Yeah. Well, it's not even like I need to watch the entire day. Like there's so many people coming by. Every 10 seconds is a microcosm of the whole day.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I can spend the rest of time talking to people, like talking to my neighbor. I found another thing I found, like you were always talking about how if you look like you're busy doing something, people will be less scared to walk up to your table. Like whenever I'd just be gossiping with my neighbor or someone come to visit me, like I'd get a huge bump in sales because I look like I'm open, but they don't have to be part of it.
Yeah.
So just, you know, be in the moment and do what you're doing. Just you constantly have opportunities to see what people are looking at and what they're, how they're reacting.
Yeah, you talk. There's a section in your post is help people get over their fears, and you know, you talked about this a little bit earlier, fear of foreigners, but also, you know, it's like in responding to different kinds of personalities in different ways, right? and watching for those cues from them, because not everybody's going to want you to look them in the eye and say hello. Like you're talking about, you know, being engaged with somebody else shows that you're engaging without having to overcome the fear of engaging with you. But then also there's some people who do want you to look them in the eye. So watching that body language, I guess, would probably be pretty helpful. And treating everybody like an individual in the moment, as you said.
Yeah, one thing I didn't talk about there is just a lot of times, like I would just walk up to my own table, like when I'd go take a break or something and come back to my own table, like I'd see it in a completely different way. Like sometimes I would have trouble finding my own table and I'd realize that's not good, you know, like I need more eye-catching stuff. Or like people don't think about the experience from the point of view of the customer. Like as when I visited cons, like so many people would like yell over me to check out their book. And when I didn't stop, they'd be like, if you buy a book, I'll give you a free poster. And I'm like, how is that gonna, if I'm not interested enough in your book to turn my head, why would I be interested enough to cover my wall in the like, you know, like,
right.
Yeah. Like it just, and they're spending so much money to print these posters. Like, instead, why don't you use the poster and put it up to catch my eye, and then I'll look at the book without you yelling at me and scaring me away, because I know if I come up, you're going to be staring at me and like, why don't you buy it? Why don't you buy it? Because you're so desperate for me to buy something.
Mm. It's interesting. So it sounds like your fellow artists run a... it sounds like the typical... the flow of customers and tabling is a little bit different in Korea, which I mean, that happens when you do business in different places in the world. There's local culture changes how people work. And that makes sense. But what's interesting, it sounds like the kind of artist personalities you're talking about seem a little more familiar. You know, it's like the whole gamut is there, like shy artists, maybe the brazen carnival barkers. You know, because
I think at the Korean show, these you don't really get a lot of carnival barker. Like I was referring to when I was at American shows. You do get some people that are friendlier than others, but it's typically a very shy show.
Okay.
In Korea.
All right. Just curious. I thought, hey, that's interesting, but no, sounds like, so that was an American show.
Yeah.
Which makes sense.
Oh, us loudmouth Americans.
Mm-hmm.
So Rob, you had a couple points in here that I think sound pretty interesting. I didn't want to steal them from you.
Okay. Well, speaking of the differences in US and Korea, I'm curious. So let's say you were coming to the US and you wanted to, and you were going to table, what would you apply from the lessons you've learned in Korea?
Well, I probably wouldn't want to bring the exact same display just because it would be set up so differently, but I would kind of want to think about, hopefully it's a show that I've been to before as a just as a visitor, and I can kind of think about what the flow of the show is, you know, and even if I hadn't, I would just kind of bring enough stuff that once I get there I can kind of see, is the stuff tend to be vertical, does stuff tend to be horizontal, and just kind of figure out who's sitting next to me and what is the customer's eye doing as they're walking down the aisle. Just kind of like, don't think about it as this is what my display looks like. Think about it as these are elements that I have to make a painting. And you're going to make a painting in the 1 hour before people start walking by realizing, like, imagine you're at a gallery show and you're like, okay, so here's a bunch of things where the points of interest are in the middle of the table. That's where people's eyes are going to be. So the thing I want them to buy goes right there. And just kind of plan your table as you go. And if it doesn't work, put something under it, make it higher, do whatever you have to direct the eye where you want it to go.
So great.
Gosh, I was just editing the last time I tabled because of what you were saying. and it's just a matter of, so really it sounds like the environmental aspect is really important for what you're saying, is like thinking of how to not like just blend or fit in to do what's happening, you know, relative to what's around you, but like, how is what is around you naturally affecting how customers are browsing? and then try to be a part of that stream of browsing appropriately.
Well, and this comes, this is a drum we've beaten on in a lot of different ways. I love how, Ryan, you're, you know, I don't know if I've heard you use these exact words, but you're comparing it a lot to being a comic book storyteller. And you talked about, you know, composition, right? And you're telling a story, and in a story, you got to get what's the point across. What's the point of the damn story? And the point of the story at your table is this book is worth buying, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's a lot of information that you need to get across in a table setup. And like in a comic, you would have pages to do it. In a table setup, it's like you have a single panel that's telling you, these are all the things I have for sale. This is how much they are. This is what's in them. And you need to figure out the clearest and concisest way to get that across without losing the audience's attention.
Great.
So great, next time, if I was ever, say I was by a wall of videos and right near eye level, it caught a lot of people's attention. And this was at FallCon this last year in St. Paul, Minnesota at the State Fairgrounds. But I was next to a video selling and kind of a nostalgia video selling store. And there was a Spider-Man. And that was right at people's eyes, and they kept commenting on Spider-Man, which is the Toei late 70s Spider-Man large, kaiju series. Anyway, and I'm like, I should have paid attention to that. And that's just, it's really cool to, you know, anyway, retroactively. I mean, it won't work in the next show, but I'm totally going to pay attention to that next time and see like what's... because you have to do some prediction ahead of time and then that follow-up too to edit partway through the day. It's like, well, that was my assumptions weren't working, so I got to fine-tune.
Yeah, like the big the next stage of what I'm gonna do for the next set of shows is like, instead of like, so far I've been building up, like I said, like displays that this goes here, this goes here, this goes here, and I can kind of tweak that in the middle. What I'm gonna do this time is just make a whole bunch of panels of all the Aki stuff and laminate them to make them about like this big, and then I can kind of stack them where I want them to be. Instead of having everything in a certain place, I can kind of be like, just make it as high as I need to or as low as I need to just by putting them in different places. Just to kind of have something that is workable for any setup that I want to do is my next step.
Modular.
Mm-hmm.
That is pretty sweet. So, I want to talk about Kickstarter in a second here.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, we got to talk about Kickstarter for sure. So that post, again, is at google.com/plusRyanEstrada, and you can dig through the archives. But again, we'll link directly to it in the show notes. Okay, so on top of all this interesting stuff, so you got these great theories on doing it wrong, you got these great observations from Korean Comic Cons, but then you put all of your theory into practice, you put your money where your mouth is, as it were, and you did this thing last year called The Whole Story at the-whole-story.com. And that was successful, right? It wound up paying for itself. Pay what you want comics. Based on or inspired by things like the Humble Indie Bundle. But digital comics, DRM-free, high-res retina quality PDFs. You're doing it again, and you're doing it on Kickstarter, and this thing, at the time of this recording, you're at $18,591 of the $2,500 goal. So first of all, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Second of all, this is where I get to throw in my two cents on the supporting this thing. Is it's got a comic in there called Plagued by Ryan Estrada. Have you read this, Rob?
I've heard the story, and yeah, I can't wait to read it.
It is so good. It's the story of how well, you could tell it better than I can, Ryan.
Well, it's a story about something that really happened to me when I was in Thailand. I was there after the tsunami cleaning up, and everyone was always giving us warnings about when to expect the next tsunami and how we would know it was coming. And one night, just all of their advice just happened to backfire by a series of coincidences of things happening that made me believe that possibly a tsunami was coming and possibly it was the apocalypse. And it was the most freaky night of my life, where I'm running around half naked in a plague of locusts, being hit by frogs flying from the sky and Hitler cats growling at me. And I was convinced that everybody was going to die, and I was trying to save the island, half naked, blind, in the dark, barefoot. And it was a fun night. I'm glad that I made the comic now, because if I'd made it when it happened, it would have just been this whole oh my god, you guys, this was so scary. But now that I can think about it, I'm like, that was kind of ridiculous, and I can make it into a comedy.
But at the same time, there's a shot in there where you are crouched by the water and you're watching the water, like, you know, I'm going to stare you down, and if this apocalypse is coming, I'm ready for it. And it's both comical, but at the same time, you totally feel your desperate heroism of that moment. I don't know what you did, but you captured it. It's a great, great moment in the comic. But anyway, it's a great comic, and Hitler cats are in it, for crying out loud. but this is just one of the many comics you get through the whole story, Kickstarter, and at the time of this recording, what is it, 13 days to go. So a couple weeks left to get in on this. 300 pages and more.
Mm-hmm.
So my first question is that you did this before and you didn't use Kickstarter. So I guess, like, I just want to know, like, what are the takeaways on switching from going with, like, what were the payment systems you were accepting before? It was PayPal?
Originally, it was through Gumroad, which is a site where people can name their price and they just get a link to download something. And I was doing that, it was going well, and then people kept asking for for PayPal. So I added a PayPal option, and suddenly it shot up. And what I realized from that is just that people respond more to things that they, you know, if you're presenting them with a new idea, it helps if it's attached to something they're already familiar with using. Because PayPal was a much worse service to use for it, because Gumroad would send it out automatically, whereas with PayPal, they would have to wait for me to wake up in the morning and mail it to them. But so many people wanted to use PayPal. And so I decided just to, you know, I knew a lot of people who were finding success building new audiences in Kickstarter. So I figured, why not just give it a try, see what happens. And I experimented with it and worked out extremely well. One of the things about Kickstarter is that I've talked to a lot of people that did it, and they said usually about like 25% of the customers come directly from Kickstarter, like new people who aren't familiar with their work and just see the thumbnail on Kickstarter and check it out. And for me, it's 41% right now of just brand new customers. And like what we've been talking about, what I've been trying to build is kind of like a new version of, like, say, the anthology, whereas instead of a book of different theme books on stories on the same theme, it's just a collection of completely different books that have nothing in common, but kind of would resonate with a similar audience. And so if you can go in for one artist and then discover the others, whereas with Kickstarter, you know, people don't have to know any of us. They can just say this artwork looks really interesting and check it out. And it's worked really well. We've gotten a lot of attention from people who had never heard of the first bundle, who don't know necessarily any of the artists, but they liked it. And I've had a lot of people that, it's name your price. So a lot of people would like pay $1 just to get access. And then they get access to some of the preview comics, and they liked it so much, they bumped their bid up to $100.
See, okay, that's an interesting thing. So you started this thing a couple weeks ago, and then after, I think, the first week, within a few days, you met your funding goal, right?
Well, we met the funding goal the first day.
Jeez,
We beat the original whole story's take in 3 days, and we doubled the original whole story's take in 2 weeks.
Wow. Okay, there's a case for Kickstarter right there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another thing, is that, you know, you pay the artists out of your own pocket for this. You pay mm-hmm. upfront costs to put together these bundles, right?
Yeah, I paid everyone an advance. Some people didn't want an advance because they said it'd stress them out, but they had the promise they would make the same amount as the advance I was offering.
Okay.
And then once the money comes in, we divvy it up, and I spend mine on advances for the next set of comics.
Yeah, it sounds like you've got a pretty good
bank to build some advances for the next comics. Mm-hmm. And now, but here's the thing is like, so you start the Kickstarter, it's not even done yet. And mm-hmm. you're a week in and you start doling out some of the rewards before the mm-hmm. thing's even completed. I'm anticipating, playing devil's advocate here, I'm anticipating somebody saying like, but how do you know that they're going to stick around now? They got some of the comics already by mm-hmm. pledging. They could just pull their pledge out and get a free comic out of the deal.
It's name your price. They can totally do that if they want. I've always found that the more I trust people, the more they trust that I am in it for them as much as I am for myself. Like every decision I make is about how do I make and keep your money, then people don't trust that I am wanting to just give them good content. But like, you know, the name your own pricing, like even this is one of those doing it wrong things. A lot of people say that's not the way to go. And even people that are on board with the whole story, you say it's great. Like I say, yeah, everyone should do name your own stuff. It's like, I don't know about that. Like what if someone pays, you know, a penny? But like when I had, when I was doing it through PayPal, like in Kickstarter, you can't pay less than a dollar. Their system just doesn't work for that. But like when I did PayPal, it was the option to pay less than a dollar. Like I didn't get any of it. Like if someone paid like 25 cents, PayPal would be like, okay, I'll take it and I'll just keep it all. But like I had two people pay less than a dollar in the entire run. Like they just didn't want to. Like if I think when I buy stuff like that, like if someone charges $10 for a PDF, I'm going to be like, that's too expensive and I'm not going to buy it. If someone charges a dollar for a PDF, I'll pay a dollar. But if they say name your price, I'm going to feel way too awkward to pay a dollar and I'm going to pay $10 just because I know that they are trusting me and I'm going to live up to that. Not everyone feels the same way as me, but enough people do that they make up for the people that don't.
No, you're talking to a guy who tips 20% or more, sometimes because they deserve it and sometimes because he just feels bad about tipping less than 20%, mm-hmm. you know? So yeah, I don't think, and here's the interesting thing is that I'm looking at the Kickstarter right now. You got some stretch goals on here. Pledge $99 or more, 5 backers. Pledge $100 or more, 16 backers. They can name their own price. And mm-hmm. they're saying, this is worth $100 to me, mm-hmm. you know? And this isn't, I want to underline this. This is the part that I think is really fascinating is this isn't you pulling a fast one on anybody. You believe in the work. If you watch the video on the Kickstarter, you can see that Ryan believes in the work. This is something that I've been noticing in a lot of articles lately. It seems that it's flying across my desk a lot, is something in the zeitgeist about we're all salesmen now, and salesmanship is not getting somebody into something, but more of evangelizing something you feel strongly about and mm-hmm. monetizing that. I was just on the Comics Are Great show last week. It'll be episode 70 when it finally goes live on the Comics Are Great site. I was talking with Stephen McCraney about a Skype tour that he did, and he put out a call on Skype saying, I'm going to give free Skype visits to schools, and there were no strings attached. Any group. You don't even have to buy my book. You don't even have to know who I am, but I'll come do a visit at your school. And he used it as a way to make hundreds of kids aware of his kids' graphic novel. And when I asked him, I was like, well, you said no strings. Wouldn't you even want him to like maybe get like a PDF of the book or something? And he said, no, you know, as I find that the more open and kind and trusting I am of people, mm-hmm. the better things come back around to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like you want people to always have the best possible experience when they deal with you in a business sense. Like even if I'm selling something to someone for a dollar, like I could just pull a fast one and like have, you know, it's a 300 pages, but 200 pages of it are filler. But then I get that dollar, but they're never going to buy anything I sell ever again. Yeah. You know, I've worked really hard to make sure that not a single page of what's in there is filler. Like in one of the recent updates, like just since we passed the stretch goal, like I decided to include brand new versions with bonus features of all the books that are already on my site, but I'm not even including that in the page count. Because those have already been free online for so long, I don't want someone to be like, "Oh, here's another 1,000 pages. Oh, I already read this." Like, I want that to be an extra thing. Oh, by the way, you also get this. Not, I'm asking for your money for that. And then you realize, oh, it's not what I expected. Like I, in the first one, I actually even hired artists to make stuff that I didn't even put in the Kickstarter because I wanted to make sure that everything flowed together and was the way I wanted it, you know?
No, it is really interesting. I mean, I find an interesting connection between some of your other thought process and how you're finding ways to relate to people, which is really close to the same kind of techniques that marketers who don't believe as much in what they're doing will employ. I mean, similar techniques, but like different motivations to apply those techniques.
And I guess it's just like a lot easier if you care about what you're doing. Like if you're marketing like soap because someone paid you a lot of money to do it, you have to like research and go to school and figure out how to relate to people about soap. But if it's like, if you're a cartoonist and you got to talk about comics, you just freaking talk about comics because you like them.
So yeah, I guess you have an easier natural resource, your enthusiasm, your energy to endure or deal with, you know, anything that comes up, you're more able to keep rolling with things and keep applying all that, all those techniques like you've been describing the thinking of, cause you know, how you relate to people. I mean, I've been writing down different quotes and I don't even know what I'm going to do with them, but like both you and Jersey said a bunch of interesting things up this episode. Let's see, if you present, if like this is a really interesting one. Just if you present an idea, a new idea, along with connecting it to something that they're already familiar with using, then people are less afraid, right? Mm-hmm. And you mentioned how this really being familiar with it, and it's like you must have there's part of the Ryan Estrada recipe that's just Ryan Estrada. Like you've got your superpower of not worrying if someone thinks what you do sucks, and being in the moment and analyzing because you're not distracted, right? Mm-hmm. And that's just I don't know. I'm reflecting on that. We're getting close to the end of the whole, I don't know how we covered like this trilogy of topics in the timeline that we did, but we did. And, yeah.
So maybe that could be a contest that we do is like grab all of the bits of Obi-Wan Kenobi ghost moments by Ryan in this episode. And we can make a book out of it, a little tiny comic out of it.
Yeah, the whole don't read about when an artist you respect was successful. Look before they were successful. And, yeah. Anyway.
Yeah, there's a bunch of them. Yeah, there's a lot of them in this one. I want to make sure that we give Ryan a chance to say anything else about the whole story because while it is live and for folks who are listening, I mean, because this ends January 31st at 12:04 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. So anything else that you wanted to throw out about the whole story?
No, if anybody likes comics and wants to check them out, go for it while you can, because another big part of the whole story is that it's not like a normal publisher where I buy the rights to things and I own them and I can make them available again. Like I just asked these artists if I could make it available in the bundle. And then after it's over, it's theirs. And I don't know how it's all going to be released again. It may be kind of a pain in the butt and a lot of different sites you got to go to get it. But here you click three buttons and you got a whole bunch of comics, more comics than you could ever read. Just fill up your iPad, fill up your computer and have comics whenever you need them.
And this comes back to something we talked about and both on Comics Are Great and on Lean Into Art is you're not selling bits, you're selling experience. This is the experience of getting everything delivered in a very convenient way. Download it, put it on your thing, and enjoy. You're not going to have this kind of ease of access in the future. This isn't you withholding stuff. This isn't you putting it in the Disney vault. It's what people, you know what I'm saying? It's like people are paying for Ryan to corral all of these artists into one place to make a convenient bundle for this particular time. That's a different thing than a paywall holding back content, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, and here's another thing that I wanted to throw out as another kind of like highlighting of the Ryan Estrada ethos is, Mr. Estrada, I was thinking about making a bundle myself. I hope you don't get mad.
Dude, awesome. The more people get used to buying comics this way, the more receptive they are when I do it.
But you did it first. I can't do it now, you know?
Humble Bundle did it first, man. And then 50 other people copied their business model, and I copied their business model but made it about comics.
Right. Yeah, see, that's
so, but yeah, like I said, the more people sell great stuff in that way, the more people are used to buying it that way, and the more, you know, like I said, the more it's attached to something people already know about, the better it is for me. But the more the thing itself becomes a known quantity, then the better it is for everybody that makes comics.
Yeah, that's a great way of looking at it. And you know, I think that's a good takeaway for folks too, because like people like to think that you can, once somebody does something, then that closes the door for everybody else to ever be able to do that thing. So, but
sure. Well, it's a lot of our examples of how people go about engaging in trade and business has to do with locking up exclusive territory. And so this is very much not that approach. It's saying it's really. Ryan's, it seems to be in business to actually make things easier, better for people, and to have as little friction involved. You know, it's like, yep, people are people, and we're afraid of things, and you know, we're going to figure out ways to make this convenient. But then, you know, you come back for the right reasons, not because you're stuck or afraid.
Yeah, and I would love people to do it also just because I want to buy comics that way. Like it's a pain in the butt for me to buy comics because I can't go walk into an American comic book store. I got to buy them digitally. And it's such a pain sometimes that like I'm constantly just loading up my iPad with stuff whenever I can find it so that when I want to take a train trip, I have stuff to read. And if someone else did that, like I've already read all the comics in my bundle, so I can't buy mine. But I would be super happy to buy someone else's bundle.
Now, as somebody who recently acquired a tablet, I feel your pain because I downloaded a whole bunch of different comics apps and now it's like, well, I got a couple things in this one, a couple things in that one. Boy, wouldn't it be nice if I just had a single folder with my entire collection that I could just go to. And the whole story comics look really, really good on the tablet. So, yeah, I hope more people do that. You got me thinking. So, but okay. Well, with that, I think it's time to go to the closing segment of the show. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Indeed.
All right. Well, then. Oh, I gotta pick a. Oh, here we go. Because we're gonna move on to quests. Does this sound like questing music? So, last episode. And we'll go through this. We'll respect your time, Ryan, and we won't spend an undue amount of time on this. But we announced the quests last time, and the quests are little interactive challenges that we're going to throw out in the Lean Into Art show, and then there will be a deadline to participate in order to get your stuff mentioned on the next Lean Into Art show. But there's no deadline on just using participating in the quests in general. And we did our first one called Mecha Sound, and I've got mine here, the piece that I did. Oh, that's not displaying very well, is it? Maybe I should switch.
You can also mention the URL, too.
Yeah. That's at leanintoart.com/quests. Oh, yeah. What a bum out, because I wanted to display mine on the screen and discuss it, because that was what the big idea was. I guess I could go to screen sharing. I don't know if I want to test that on Google Hangouts this late in the game, you know? We had such a good thing going.
Well, fearless experimentation is part of the theme of the day. And along with that, I want to make sure, Ryan, you are very welcome to comment or question anything we're doing right now. We would only benefit from your thoughtful feedback or harsh, flaming words, either way.
Well, while Jersey's doing that, while we're talking about challenges, I want to point out that on my game show, I had a challenge about visiting this very site. That involved getting from leanintoart.com to Humble Bundle. And while we have just mentioned Humble Bundle in the show, and it probably will be mentioned in the show notes, don't be a cheater and click that link.
Did anybody beat the four clicks that you used
to get? Oh,
the
God. Like, people did it in like two.
Wow.
Like, what was interesting is no one had the same way. Like, every single person had a completely different way to get there.
Wow.
That's awesome.
Proof.
Apparently, Rob, you did an episode of Polytechnicast where you linked to Humble Bundle. A lot of people are finding that one.
Mm, yep. Oh. Funny.
Okay, so I got screen sharing working somehow or another, and I just wanted to share my work that I did, and I will show you here. I went ahead and posted my whole process of coming up with it. The quest this time was to come up with three sound effects because I kicked it off, and this is my area of fascination. And I chose a rusty old tractor starting up, an air conditioner in use, and someone making an espresso. And as you can see, I'll just breeze through this real quick. I started out by drawing like a sort of a waveform slash pitch path of what the sound looked like in my head. Just like sort of hearing a blurry version of the sound. And then using that as a starting point, I started working out the spelling of the sound. And this is going to be useless to people listening in audio, but you should be watching the video anyway. And then they were.
I'm hearing some theater of the mind going on.
Okay. But then I got to my final draft in Adobe Illustrator. And I mean, I guess I could describe this for people in the audio is that, you know, I'm drawing a waveform like you would see on an oscilloscope. But then I'm also following sort of a pitch path of low pitch goes down, high pitch goes up. And then I'm also using size. And as a matter of fact, I mean, you know, we did a whole episode on this episode, I think 14, which was Men of Letters, where I talked about this in a lot more detail. But I think the most interesting sound that I discovered was the espresso machine, where as I was sounding it out, I was remembering that espresso machines make these kind of puffs of sound. It's like, rah, 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 between the, which is what I did at the desk. I was making those sounds at the desk. And that was, design-wise, that was the most interesting part for me. So, okay, now's the opportunity for you guys to critique.
It's so funny as you're talking, and this is going to sound silly, but I literally heard, isn't it like a song from James Bond years ago that nobody does it better, right? Yeah, because funny. I'm just reminded of all the lessons I've sat through now of you teaching about sound, and this is totally the way of the drozd, right? You put so many interesting details and texture into your sounds that then it's like you find a way to visualize the rhythm and textural effects, translating something that even the word texture, and we use rhythm and whatnot back and forth between our language talking about comics and then talking about, you know, music or audio. Like, you get that to become the onomatopoeia of, you know, some related arrangement of the letters in their order. And then all of a sudden just distorting and pushing them together to then all of a sudden this texture comes out that I think it's just neat to watch. It's like how would I, I didn't have anything other than like glowing admiration there. Sorry, Jersey.
I've got a critique of my own is that I did notice when I did the air conditioner sound effect that when I did it in all caps, it felt way too present. It felt like it was the loudest air conditioner in the world. And that's why I did a second version in lowercase letters, basically mimicking the same path and same rhythm and everything, but it felt like it needed to be pushed back. Ryan, were you going to say something?
Yeah, I was going to say, I love the way you use the contrast in the sound, like how the tractor, at some points it's so small and some points it's so big. Like, that's one of those doing it wrong things. Like, if you look at any book on how to make comics, or like when you buy the paper, the special guides, like sound effects go here, they're this size. Whereas like if this were in a panel that HRRUBB would like take up like a big chunk of the panel, which a lot of... all of those things would say was wrong. But if you really wanted to draw attention, if this was important to the story, there's no problem with having a sound effect just suddenly fill the page and make the audience see it and think about it.
Yeah, this is kind of a little bit of an unfair exercise in the sense that I'm asking people to create sound effects out of context, right? Because mm-hmm. there's a whole other realm of concerns when you're integrating it into an actual panel and into a story. But mm-hmm. as a thinking exercise in general, I think it's a worthy experiment. And yeah, like with the tractor sound, I was thinking of the kind of like the of trying to turn it over. And then there's a little click just before the engine turns over. There's always this little, you hear like metal hitting metal, and then the big rumble of the roar of the engine kicking over. And then I chose mm-hmm. a larger font, a wobbly line. You'll notice there's a smoother line as the rumble continues and the motor is fully engaged and running. But in that initial turnover, I used a distorted line. So with that, I want to move to Rob's. Let's look at yours, Rob.
All right. As I started to engage in the quest, I was it was really funny. I read more comics than I mentioned, but some of them, the ones that have just a huge influence on me, I keep coming back to. And I think of the Nausicaa of the Valley of the Wind from
Hayao Miyazaki.
Yeah, Hayao Miyazaki. And he had so many, like, both natural phenomena sound effects that he'd included, such as, like, the Omu crawling around and the just all these different huge airplane battle fortresses and stuff. And, like, so many things, like, just had sounds. And like, I think for me, a lot of the, it was the context of onomatopoeia put next to what it was modifying. Helps a lot. Like, so I arranged it all in one big old panel that or, you know, just one illustration where it's, you know, it's a tractor pulling a cart, like sort of as if someone set up a business of you know, a coffee shop inside of a some kind of weird shack they built. Yet for some reason the person serving and making coffee has popped out of the roof anyway. And of course, it's very hot and they need an air conditioner. So, this is all, these elements get to work and play together. And then I ended up adding a few extra sound effects as I was sort of playing with this of like, well, what convinces me of what's going on? So I went more, more basic and less, in some ways, less explicit with the sound and just letting the thing it's next to help sell it, which, so for the tractor and yeah. And then I also used, other visual language, like, action lines surrounding sound being inside of puff of smoke and sound next to what it's meant to be conveying the noise of and whatnot. Anyway.
Yeah. That so context you're, great point in pointing to Nausicaa, because that is an awesome series for looking at sound usage, because you're right. Miyazaki does a really great job of integrating, well, the translations, I should say. The translations do a great job of integrating what is immediately familiar to us, and you talk about the Omu and the kind of noises they make, and it's more abstract, right? Because this is something that we don't have any context for what a big bug like this sounds like, whereas with wind...
No one but Ryan Estrada has seen a bus-sized insect.
Possibly, but yeah, like you've got like the familiarity of the whoo of wind, where you don't have to go all crazy with that. You can rely on the reader's life experience and life context and the context mm-hmm. of the image. So when you have this chafouche coming out of the steam on the top of the tractor, you've got the context of the steam, but you also have the context of our own experience to know that, okay, this is a familiar noise to us. So it's you can be less abstract with that. But then there's things like, what is the noise that you've got in the very front of the tractor and the upper right corner of the tractor's front?
Upper this one?
Yeah.
I was picturing like, well, what if the engine, so I didn't make a great rusty tractor in the image, but I was thinking like, well, this tractor does have a lot of mechanical difficulties. So interpreting it. So since I'm showing the engine exposed, like there are, probably cracked hoses and maybe a leaky head gasket kind of thing. And it's just, so that's like a pop coming out of the engine just because it's in bad condition. and then building off of that up above the tractor is the hrim plop, you know, like it's making these jalopy sounds a little bit.
And I like the angling on the letters too. I like the idea of using a shape around the sound effect. And it's not an enclosed shape. It's not a word balloon as such, but it's a shape to indicate part of the quality of the sound. This kind of makes me think of like 1930s comics, like E.C. Seeger kind of stuff, and how he incorporated sound. He would include them within little puffs like this at times.
Are you staring at me?
Ryan, are we keeping you from
No.
Okay.
No, not at all. So, she was just hadn't heard me in a while. I was wondering if I was done. But so one thing I was going to say is that, like, an important thing is to think about all the things that the people who followed the challenge have done is to think about the same art that they did and would they use it in different contexts? Because we were talking before about think about the context of something like with the tractor, like if you were making a story about a farmer having an argument with his wife and there was a trailer in the tractor in the background, it might just be a small little thing in the background to show that it was running. Whereas like in the Rats of Nim, like, is that the one where the tractor was coming and it was going to kill everyone? Like in that one, the fact that the tractor has started is a big friggin' deal.
Yes.
Because it's going to run over all the animals. That's when you get like the one Jersey did where it fills the screen because that's the potential for death. You know, it's fun to play with things and how those changes can affect the audience.
Yeah. So cool, Rob. You went all out. Thanks. I mean, you did a full on illustration for yours. So you threw the gauntlet down for future
participants. It's a little bit of just what felt natural. I just kind of went with it and felt the impish joy of connecting all these dots and then making it into one big exercise. So, but yeah, thanks.
So also Lee competed or joined the challenge, and let me pull his up. I just wanted to show that quickly on screen before we move on to the new quest. And I had it on Twitter here. I thought I downloaded it, but it didn't download properly. So I'll go ahead and do another screen share real quick. So here's Lee's share selected window. Please, thank you. Oh, don't kill the Hangout. Okay, cool. You guys see it?
Mm-hmm. See it.
This is Control-Alt-Lee on Twitter, and he did a woom 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 with a large fuzzy N and N, like a N over top of the sound. So this kind of overlapping sound. And this was his air conditioner noise, was like, and I love this idea of using a scribbly line to indicate the kind of the texture and quality of the hum of the thing. And then the woom 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 being overlapped by it. Like they're overlaying each other. And I remember it made me think of a Star Trek Next Generation episode where Picard and the crew gets to see through Geordi's eyes for the first time. Like they hook up like some kind of monitor into his goggles and they're seeing through his eyes and it looks like static. And Picard is saying to Geordi, is like, well, how is it that you can make out shapes into all that input? And Geordi says, well, how do you discern different sounds in a noisy room? And when you think about it, there's lots and lots of sounds going on in a noisy room, yet we can still pick out a conversation or isolate a certain noise. What was that? Is there scratching going on over there? So sound can be layered like this. And I love that kind of immediacy that he created with this design.
It's a very familiar feeling to it as well. Like the repetitive rhythm and the overlap. And the onomatopoeia, it's like I'm there, and it's those kind of sounds are particularly hypnotizing.
I will link to Lee's entry to the Heroic Challenge in the show notes at leanintoart.com. So quickly, let's move on to what is this episode's challenge, Rob?
Our next challenge is Lean Into Art Quest 2. What's that? Do we need a bumper?
Oh, no, no. Right. Oh, do you want me to? You want me to give you a sound cue?
No, we're all good. Bumperless. Let's roll. So Lean Into Art Quest 2 is called Harvester of Borrow. it's a reflective writing exercise. And so what I'm looking at is what every artist is inspired by another artist's work, and inspiration can be an interesting cue to the things that, you know, it's like Jersey has used this lesson before, where something causes you a, gives you pause, whether it's, you know, it's some surprise, excitement, fear, what have you. Sometimes it's an incredible, learnable moment where all of a sudden you can, see how that could channel into your work and what, why is this causing that effect on you? And so taking that into inspiration and saying, well, it doesn't always have to be direct follow-up inspiration too. Sometimes it can lead, you know, you can see how, like a song can lead you into making a comic, or perhaps a painting leads to a comic, or a song leads to a book, or a video game you played led to writing a short story. Whatever it is, here's the quest. The normal quest, well, name a creative work, and a little note about how it affected something you make. And if possible, give a link to the creative work and the thing you made. There you go. That could be as brief as a tweet or a tiny, tiny Tumblr post. Now, the heroic quest is a deeper writing exercise. So a paragraph or more, write a post about the thing that inspired you and what you made from that inspiration. And all you have to do to turn in this quest is post a link to it via Twitter with the hashtag LiaQuest2. That's LiaQuest2. And if you'd like to offer a power-up, so this, the power-up is a way, you know what? It's a fun way to participate, to cheer along and just, you know, play in the conversation and maybe and help encourage others who are taking on the, this challenge. So there are many examples of how artists will share their in, things that inspired them. And one thing in particular to give a little cheat is I noticed like a template, a poster format that a lot of visual artists were using to call up visual examples of things that inspired them. I forget the name of the template, but it ebbs and flows. It gets passed around a lot.
Yeah, I see them get passed around on Tumblr a lot.
So share a link to that kind of post and whatever it is about an artist talking about others' work where, so it basically, if someone else did a post like this, go ahead and post a link to it on Twitter and add the hashtag LiaQuest2.
Awesome. So cool. So hashtag LiaQuest2 is the new quest hashtag to use, and the deadline to get your quest materials responded to on the air is January 30th, 2013, because the next show will be January 31st, 2013. So if you're watching live or watching shortly after this goes live, or rather gets posted on the Lean and Tart website, time's a-wastin'. Get on it, as the kids say. So, okay, well, with that, I think we can wrap this guy up, and we got to thank Ryan. Ryan, this was 80 pounds of content in a 20-pound bag, man. Mm. Oh, my gosh. I can't believe we fit it all in the time that we had.
Anytime.
Yep. Thank you for putting up with our questions and our endless adoration for your work.
Thank you very
and
much.
We should say that for those who are watching live, Wednesday, January, oh, gosh, what day does that fall on? Where's my calendar?
What's this?
The next show, that's going to be the 23rd.
Yeah, Wednesday, January 23rd at, you said 8 p.m. Eastern time. Mm-hmm. And that's where you can find Ryan's next game show, Asking for Trouble. Dave Roman, Dean Tripp are going to be on. It should be a lot of fun. I'm going to watch. So, and then do check out the Kickstarter, the whole story Kickstarter. Just do a search for the whole story Kickstarter. We'll link to it in the show notes as well. 13 days to go at the time of this recording. So again, time's a wasting on that too. You only got until, well, the deadline's about the same for the quest in order to get 300 pages or more of amazing comics for whatever price you want to pay.
Yeah, I think it's up to like well over 2,000 pages for the that are available at various levels. But yeah, it's a lot of comics. Check it out. the-whole-story.com.
And I mean, I'll put, you know, my full endorsement behind it. I mean, I've read The Kind. I've read Plagued.
I've read The Kind. I haven't read Plague yet.
I'll send you a copy.
It's so good. It's so good. Fusion
well,
Future.
I did support the whole story as well. So yeah, you know, I am a supporter.
and you know, there's just a lot of amazing comics in there, and you won't be sorry for and like you can pledge a buck if you want. So, but I got a feeling that you'll pledge more, like a lot of people did. So, anyway, Ryan, thank you as always for lending such awesome insights to the show. And thanks everybody for watching and listening. Thank you, Rob, for helping me out with this one.
Well, no problem, man. Thank you, Jersey, for your awesome work in helping prepare us to be successful at this endeavor. So,
okay, well, this show will be available at leanintoart.com. And until next time, everybody, I have been Jersey Drozd of leanintoart.com and Jersey on Twitter.
And I've been Rob Stenzinger, also of Lean Into Art. And yet on Twitter, I'm Rob Stenzinger.
And I'm Brian Estrada, RyanEstrada.com.
And okay, bye.
Show notes for this episode can be found at leanintoart.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at the user leanintoart, and you can reach us via email at leanintoart@gmail.com. And remember, leaners aren't wieners. Thanks for listening.